back up. If the war really had ended, the guards were hiding it from the POWs. The kill-all date was 5 days away. The next day, Louis was sicker still. He'd been vomiting for 2 days. He scrawled sad words in his diary. Look like skeleton. Feel weak. The bird reappeared. Louis saw him outside. He watched the sergeant's back as he stepped into his office and closed the door. On the 17th of August at Rokuroshi POW camp on the frigid summit of a Japanese mountain, a telephone rang. Phil, Fred Garrett, and the other Rokuroshi POWs were shivering through the summer. The guards had nailed the barracks doors shut. In this remote, deathly quiet camp, the telephone hardly ever rang, and the POWs noticed it. A few minutes later, the Japanese commander hurried down the mountain. All summer, the Rokuroshi prisoners had been racked with tension. The sky was scratched with bomber vapor trails. One night in July, the horizon had lit up red, generating light so bright the men could read by it. On August 15th, the guards had suddenly become much more brutal. After the commander left, something troubling happened. The guards began dividing the POWs into small groups and herding them deep in the forest, then back to camp. Later, the walks were repeated. The guards seemed to be habituating the men to this routine in preparation for something terrible. On August 20th, under a threatening sky, there was a shout in the Naoetsu compound. All POWs were to assemble outside. The camp commander spoke, a translator beside him. The war has come to a point of cessation. There was no reaction from the POWs. Some believed it, but kept silent for fear of reprisal. Others thought it was a trick. With the POWs waiting in suspicious silence, the translator invited the men to bathe in the river. This was odd. The men had almost never been allowed in the river. Louis and the others dragged down to the water, dropping clothes, and waded in. They scattered, scrubbing their skin, unsure what was happening. Then they heard it. It was the howl of an aircraft engine, huge, low, and close. The swimmers looked up and at first saw nothing but white sky. Then, there it was, bursting from the clouds. A torpedo bomber. As the men watched, the bomber dove, leveled off, and skimmed over the water, engine screaming. It was headed straight toward the POWs. In the instant before the plane shot overhead, the POWs could just make out the cockpit and inside the pilot, standing. Then the bomber was upon them. On each side of the fuselage, there was a broad white star in a blue circle. The plane wasn't Japanese. It was American. The plane's red code light blinked frantically. A POW read the signals and suddenly cried out, "Oh, the war is over!" In seconds, masses of naked men were stampeding up the hill. As the plane turned loops above, the POWs swarmed the camp, out of their minds with relief and rapture. Their fear of the guards and the massacre they'd awaited was gone, dispersed by the muscle of the bomber. The prisoners jumped, shouted, and sobbed. Some scrambled onto the roofs, waving and singing out to the pilot above. Others piled against the camp fence, sent it crashing over, and lit it on fire. The Japanese shrank back and withdrew. In the midst of the celebrating men, Louis stood on wavering legs, wet, emaciated, and sick. In his tired mind, two words were repeating themselves over and over, "I'm free, I'm free, I'm free." A battered Australian was sitting at the water's edge, watching the bomber, when he saw something flit out of the cockpit and fall toward the river. He stood up and leaned far over the water, arms outstretched. The object, a wooden packet, dropped into his hands. Regaining his balance with the treasure in his grasp, he had a delightful thought. Chocolate! He opened the packet and realized to his immense disappointment that it wasn't chocolate. It held a message from the pilot, saying he'd lead supply planes back the next day to drop food. Before he flew off, the pilot dropped a candy bar with a bite taken out of it. Fitzgerald had it sliced into 700 slivers, and each man licked a finger, dabbed it on his bit of chocolate, and put it in his mouth. Louis's portion was the size of an ant. Another American plane thrummed over, and a man fell from it. Down he fell, and no parachute opened. Everyone gasped. Then they realized it wasn't a man. It was a pair of pants, stuffed with something. The officers retrieved the pants, and Louis stood by as they were opened. Inside were cigarettes and candy bars, and the compound was soon littered with wrappers and naked, skinny, smoking men. Also in the pants was an American magazine. On the cover was a photograph of an impossibly massive bomb cloud. The men fell silent, piecing together the rumors of one giant bomb vaporizing a city and the abrupt end to the war. The rock still sat by the barracks window, Louis's rope around it. But the conspirators were too late. The bird was gone. Sometime that day, or perhaps the day before, he'd slipped into the countryside and vanished. Chapter 32. Cascades of Pink Peaches. On August 22nd, Phil and Fred Garrett sat in Rokuroshi, wondering what was happening. They'd been told nothing of the war's end. All they knew was that the Japanese commander had been gone for 5 days, and the guards had been leading them on ominous marches through the forest. That afternoon, the Japanese commander walked into the barracks. "The Emperor has brought peace to the world," he said. He surrendered his sword. That night, the POWs threw a party to end all parties. Demolishing the fence, they built a gigantic pile of wood. They got a barrel of rice wine. Drinking began, the bonfire was lit, an Alabaman transformed a huge can into a drum, and tipsy men began dancing. A conga line of crazy drunk POWs wrapped around camp, and one man did a terrible striptease. The revelry was so riotous that one POW was surprised everyone survived the night. The following day, the hungover POWs walked down the mountain to find mostly ghost towns. The civilians had seen the bonfire and fled. The POWs hiked back up and waited for help to come. At Naoetsu, the guards were suddenly fawning and submissive. Only the Japanese commander was defiant, haughtily refusing Fitzgerald's repeated demands for food for his starving men. On the morning of August 26th, 6 days after the war's end was announced in Naoetsu, American fighter planes arrived. The POWs charged outside, yelling. They painted two giant words on the ground in white lime: "Food, smokes." Messages dropped from the cockpits. The planes had been hauling emergency supplies to POW camps, but had exhausted their loads. The pilots promised food would soon come. Unable to feed the POWs, the pilots did the next best thing, putting on an air show while the prisoners shouted and wept. The show had a persuasive effect on the Japanese commander. Japanese trucks soon arrived, and out came rations, biscuits, and canned fruit. That afternoon, more planes flew over, and as the POWs ran for their lives, bags began thumping down. Each man received half a tin of tangerines, one pack of biscuits, two cigarettes, and candy. Concerned that it wasn't nearly enough food, Fitzgerald had someone write 700 PWs here, on the ground. Someone waded into the river to grab an errant bag and in it found magazines. The war, the magazine said, had ended on August 15th. The speaker Wade had heard on the guards' radio that day had been Emperor Hirohito. So for 5 days, seven in the case of Rokuroshi, the Japanese had deceived the POWs to hide the fact that the war was over. The reason was almost certainly that they were awaiting instruction on whether to carry out the kill-all order. 3 days after the fighters flew over, the Americans sent in the big boys. Six loaded B-29s. Giant pallets poured out, swinging under red, white, and blue parachutes. The first load hit the compound. Others fell into nearby rice paddies, pursued by hundreds of gleeful living skeletons. One canister bore a message written in chalk. Bombed here in May 45. Sorry I missed. Boxes fell all over the landscape. Some civilians pulled them into their homes. Others, though in great hardship, dragged them into camp. Pallets banged down and broke open. Cascades of pink peaches spilled over the countryside. A crate exploded and the sky rained peas. Louis and Tinker just missed being totaled by a drum full of shoes that shot through the Benjo roof. To prevent disaster, someone ran onto the road and wrote, "Drop here." Food, medicine, and clothing fell in such abundance that Fitzgerald asked a man to check that whoever had written 700 PWs here hadn't accidentally added a zero. Eventually, someone climbed on a roof and wrote, "No more. Thanks." An orgy of eating commenced. Men crammed their stomachs full, then had seconds and thirds. Louis shoveled an entire can's worth of condensed soup into his mouth, too hungry to add water. Three men drank 2 gallons of cocoa. At nightfall, the eating stopped. Men, upended by swollen stomachs, drifted off to sleep. Louis lay among them, swaddled in an American parachute. In its rampage over the East, Japan had brought atrocity and death on a scale that staggers the imagination. In the midst of it were prisoners of war. Japan held some 132,000 POWs from America, Britain, Canada, New Zealand, Holland, and Australia. Of those, nearly 36,000 died, more than one in every four. Japan also held more than 215,000 POWs from other nations and untold thousands of forced laborers. Their death rates are unknown. Americans fared particularly badly. Of the 34,648 Americans held by Japan, 12,935, more than 37%, died. By comparison, only 1% of Americans held by the Nazis and Italians died. Japan murdered thousands of POWs on death marches and worked thousands of others to death in slavery. Thousands of other POWs were beaten, burned, stabbed, or clubbed to death, shot, beheaded, murdered in medical experimentation, and eaten alive in ritual acts of cannibalism. And as a result of being fed grossly inadequate and befouled food and water, thousands more died of starvation and easily preventable diseases. Under the kill-all order, the Japanese massacred all 5,000 Korean captives on Tinian, all the POWs on Balali, Wake, and Tarawa, and all but 11 POWs at Palawan. They were evidently about to murder all the other POWs and civilian internees in their custody when the atomic bomb brought their empire crashing down. On September 2, 1945, Japan signed its formal surrender. The Second World War was over. For Louis, these were days of bliss. Though sick and weak, he glowed with euphoria. Days earlier, he would have killed the bird without remorse. Now, the vengeful urge no longer had sure footing. The bird was gone, and all Louis felt was rapture. He and other POWs doled out supplies to civilians, stood in circles of Japanese children, handing out chocolate, and brought food and clothing to the guards for their families. Gorging brought consequences. Bodies that had spent years scraping by on seaweed were overwhelmed. Now Etsu became a festival of rapid-fire diarrhea. The Benjo lines wound everywhere, and men, unable to wait, began dropping their pants and fertilizing Japan wherever the spirit moved them. Then they resumed feasting. All over Japan, more than 1,000 planes saturated POW camps with nearly 4,500 tons of spam and fruit cocktail, soup, chocolate, medicine, and countless other treasures. At Omori, Bob Martindale was sitting in the bird's old office, savoring his freedom, when an enormous box sailed out of the sun, hit the ground, and exploded, obliterating the office in a cataclysm of American cocoa powder. Martindale stumbled out, caked head to toe in cocoa, but otherwise uninjured. Everyone in camp was eager to get home, but Fitzgerald received a radio message telling him to wait for an evacuation team to arrive on September 4th. So the POWs waited, eating, smoking, eating, celebrating, swimming, and eating more. Someone broke into a storehouse and discovered some 1,500 Red Cross boxes, hidden by the Japanese while the POWs starved. Louis ate voraciously, got stronger, and expanded in all directions, his body bloating from water retention. September 4th arrived. The evacuation team never showed up. More than 2 weeks had passed since the men had learned the war was over, and Fitzgerald was sick of waiting. He walked to the train station and asked a Japanese official to arrange for a train to be there the next day. The official refused. Commander Fitzgerald had been in Japanese custody since April 1943. For 2.5 years, he'd been forced to grovel before sadists and imbeciles as he tried to protect his men. He'd been starved, beaten, waterboarded, and enslaved, and had had his fingernails torn out. He was done negotiating. He hauled back and punched the station official in the face. The next morning, the train was there, right on time. On September 5th, Louis stepped from the barracks for the last time. Outside, the POWs were congregating, holding what few possessions they had. The British Commonwealth soldiers held the boxes bearing the remains of the 60 Aussies who had died in camp. Determined to leave this indecent place with dignity, the men assembled behind their nation's flags. Together, they marched through the gate toward wives and sweethearts and mom and dad and home. Louis glanced back. The sickest POWs remained behind, awaiting transport the next day. Fitzgerald stayed with them, unwilling to leave until the last of his men was liberated. As he crossed over the bridge, and now Etsu passed out of view, Louis raised his arm and waved the war goodbye. Chapter 33 Mother's Day. The now Etsu POWs had control of the train. At each village, the train squealed to a stop and the men piled off, then piled back on, laden with wine. The men grew rowdier. The lieutenant told them to behave themselves. He didn't want any men falling overboard. His warning did no good. All afternoon, drunken POWs fell off the train. One of them was the lieutenant himself. Across Japan, as POW trains snaked toward Yokohama, the men saw what the B-29s had done. Once grand cities were now black stains. Seeing the destruction of the enemy that had enslaved and tormented them and murdered their friends, the POWs cheered. But after the first city, there was another, then another. city after city razed, survivors drifting like specters. The cheering died away. On Louis' train, the silence came at Tokyo. A week after Louis left Omori, 16 square miles of the city and tens of thousands of souls had been burned by B-29s.